we think we know about cosmology and where it actually is coming from. So if we draw a table here and say, you know, what we observe and compare it to what we deduce from these observations, the major pieces of cosmology, the major observables, is we have the Hubble expansion. And so what we observe is we observe that distant things have redshift, from which we deduce a velocity. And we see that they have a certain luminosity. And if they're standard candles, we use that to deduce a distance. And from this, we deduce that everything is an isotropic expansion. Everything is expanding away from us with the given Hubble law that the velocity that we observe is equal to h times the distance. And finally, the distant supernova tell us that this expansion is accelerating. We're measuring V and D respect to us. And when we plot that, we come up with these conclusions. So the supernova are, the point is that the supernova are distant. And so by telling, if you just plot basically distance and V in some schematic way, nearby H is constant, but as you go further out, you're looking further back in time, and so you start to see H, you'd expect to see H doing one of these behaviors, that H is either decelerating, staying constant, or accelerating. And when you go out to the supernova, which is the most distant things, the data are schematically lying up here. So they tell us that the universe is accelerating, that the expansion rate right now is larger. So it's just that the point with the supernova is that it's they're just the most distant things. Is there an eraser around here somewhere?
Yes.
And the supernova are distant standard candles. So all this is contingent on how much do you really trust the fact that we know the luminosity of the supernova, in which case, from which we deduce the distance, and then we get the redshift, and we make this Hubble diagram.
Observing the redshift, how do we know it's just due to velocity, some curvature?
Well, this is a curvature effect. I mean, when we, if you actually look at these velocities, if you naively interpreted them just as velocities, some of them would be superluminal. So it's not a physical velocity. We do interpret it as an expansion of the universe, a curvature effect. And when we write down the FRW metric, you'll see exactly that this is a curvature effect. No, it's all on the instantaneous redshift.
And there's never a transverse.
In nearby things, you can measure their transverse motion on the sky and try to get a proper motion from that. But distant things, those are really, really small. Okay, so the expansion is accelerating. This is really, really weird. Because if you have a universe with either matter or radiation, you would expect the acceleration, the expansion to be decelerating. The fact that the expansion is accelerating tells us that either GR is wrong or that there's the so-called dark energy, something besides matter and radiation. So this is one of the major puzzles I'm sure you've heard about in cosmology. If you just have matter and radiation plus GR, you should have seen decelerating expansion.
Quantum field theory on space-time.
This isn't anything quantum. To get this kind of, this just follows straight from the Friedman equation. So there's nothing quantum about, there's no quantum component that comes into this statement that if you have a universe that's filled with matter and radiation and you apply GR to it, you would expect decelerating expansion. Yes. And so whether you interpret a cosmological constant as, yes, we need a cosmological constant, you can say that in either framework. When you have... When I write it this way, I mainly mean, something is wrong here. If you only include matter and radiation, then this is inconsistent. So you can either fix something on this end, i.e. modify GR, or you can add something on this end, i.e. add dark energy. When it comes to a cosmological constant, it can kind of be interpreted either way. But yes, a cosmological constant can do this. And the point here is also that the fraction of the energy density in this mysterious component is about 70%. So 70% of the energy density in the universe comes from this mysterious accelerating phase. That comes from fitting these curves with the supernova data. You get fits. You know how much matter there is from another source, counting clusters, basically counting stuff in the sky. And that combined with the supernova gives you about 70%. Please, ask away. The 70%?
Assuming that you believe that we have all
the systematic symmetry control. Mm-hmm. The 70% air burst? On the order of 70 plus or minus, when you put all the data together, supernova plus CMB, it's on the order of like 70 plus or minus 1%. It's really good. Okay. The other big observable, or another big observable that we have, is Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So what we observe is that we have, it seems to be we have primordial helium. So you look out into space and you see clouds that have no stars in them, and we surmise they've never had stars, and yet there's helium present. So there seems to be some source of helium in the universe that was not created in stars. More importantly, there also seems to be quite a bit of deuterium hanging around. And that's even stranger because deuterium is actively destroyed by stars. And so if there's deuterium in the universe, in these clouds, where did it come from? Stars generally don't emit or release deuterium. They eat deuterium. And there's also some lithium, it seems to be, in these primordial clouds. And so what we deduce from that is that we had a hot early universe that nuclear synthesis happened in. And you can go through the calculations, and what you find is that the density in baryons compared to the total density of the universe, is on the order of 0.42 plus or minus 0.003. These air bars partly come from BBM, partly come from the CMB. And that's a mega baryon. So that the BBN tells us by just measuring how much helium, deuterium, and lithium there is in this primordial clouds, that the universe was very hot initially, and we've got a measure on the fraction of the energy density in baryons. And what this also tells us to really good constraints is that everything we know about about nuclear synthesis and nuclear physics and the decay of the neutron, et cetera, is all still applicable in the first 3 minutes of the Big Bang, that it all works.
What does that mean, the first 3 minutes of the Big Bang? So, does
it mean anything? So if you plot... so what does that mean? So if you just ask what temperature is necessary to produce these elements, we're talking about an MeV. And if you look at the CMB, that gives you kind of a history of how the temperature is evolving in time. And so you can ask, how long ago was the temperature about 1 MeV? Also, you can ask, how long after the singularity that shows up when you drive the expansion backwards and you collapse it down to a point, how long after that singularity was the temperature about an MeV? And that answer is about 3 minutes. That one's actually pretty accurate. I mean, when you have a universe that contains nothing but radiation, the temperature and the time are intimately connected. I mean, there's a concrete mathematical relationship between if you just fill a universe, you start it with zero volume, you fill it with radiation, and you let it expand. The temperature and the time are directly related. So if you know what temperature something happened, you know very concretely what time it happened.
And this is for an observer who's just floating. How do you define time?
This is a co-moving observer who is at rest, and at rest relative to the expansion of the universe.
And this fraction is at what time?
And this fraction is today. This is evaluated and extrapolated forward to today. So today, we've got about 4% of the universe in baryonic matter.
So how do we observe the baryonic matter? Is it gas clouds which are very different?
Well, so the best, you can try to do that. You can try to look around locally and try to measure the baryons and look at how much light, how many stars. That ends up with a missing baryon problem. We're kind of missing about half of them. Where you get this number from is when you do actually the calculations of how much helium, deuterium, and lithium you get in the early universe, how many protons and neutrons you started with comes into that calculation very, very strongly. So you can extrapolate back by how much primordial helium back to this number. This number also comes from the CMB. The peak structure of the CMB gives you a handle on how much baryons there actually are.
So my question is, where exactly is the observation? What is the data from the experiment?
So the two pieces of data is the percentage of helium in these clouds. It's about 24% helium.
And where are the clouds?
Where are these clouds? You're kidding me. These are intergalactic.
Yeah. So how does one see them? How do you detect them?
I really don't know.
The species is not hard because you have the absorption line. So
it's not
the
formula,
but it's helium.
You've got absorption lines. It's quasar spectra is a big one that you look at. You use a quasar as a backlight. And you look at the emission from it, and you see all these troughs of absorption from the clouds that it hit along the way. And from those, you can get a handle on what those clouds contained.
And also the relative distribution of the various...
And the various elements. And you can also look in galaxies and get a distribution there. And you can kind of see how that tracks, how much stellar population there is in that galaxy. And you can extrapolate down to zero stellar population. And that also gives you a number for what was the primordial helium abundance. The CMB is an even better one. When you have the CMB power spectrum, so I think that actually is next on my list. The CMB is the other big piece to the cosmological puzzle. And what we observe is nearly perfect 3-degree Kelvin black body radiation. From everywhere, all directions, all the time. With tiny, one part in 100,000 fluctuations in the temperature. And when you plot the power spectrum of these fluctuations, you end up with this is P of K, basically as a function of K, although it's usually written in terms of L because it's on a sphere. you end up with a very distinctive peak structure. And because of the peak structure comes from the way the baryons and the photons were coupled before the CMB was created. And from there, from this peak structure, you can get a measurement. You can fit for what a megabaryon is. Basically, you add more baryons, all the even peaks go up, and the odd peaks go down. Okay, so what do we deduce from the CMB? We deduced a lot. We deduced all these numbers from the CMB. But the big key points that we deduced from the CMB is that the universe is flat. And what I technically mean by that is that the spatial part of the universe's metric is a Euclidean flat space metric that is uniformly expanding. But Euclidean geometry holds. And another way we're going to see what that means is that what I've been writing, I'll get to that later when I have the formula down. We get this measurement again. We get a measurement for the total matter density of the universe. That is 0.278 plus or minus 0.013. for the percentage of the universe's energy that is in matter. And the fact that this, plus this equals one comes from the fact the universe is flat.
Sorry, what do you mean by the universe is flat?
I'll put it in terms of words, and I'll get to equations in a second. But in terms of words, what this means is that the metric of the universe, the spatial part of it, is a flat metric. It's not the surface of a sphere. It's not the surface of a hyperbola. It's a flat Euclidean. Triangles add up to 180 degrees space.
The baryons are part of the matter. What are you asking?
Oh, this includes, yes.
Yes, so you should have them.
No, you're right. You shouldn't. I got in trouble with it. So this is actually, to be more precise, this is 72 and change. These two add up to one. The baryons are part of the matter. But as you can see, there's a lot more there than the baryons. And when we talk about the CMB, what is the distinguishing feature between what we call baryonic matter and what we call total matter? As far as the CMB is concerned, it's the fact that it's mutual. So the CMB is at temperatures where the electrons and the protons have not combined to form hydrogen. So you've got protons and electrons flying around, and then you've got some other kind of matter that is neutral and long-lived, so it's not neutrons. And this is what the distinguishing characteristic is as far as the CMB is concerned, that the CMB gives omega matter independently from omega baryon. This is the stuff that couples to photons at those temperatures. This is the stuff that doesn't. And this is also the discrepancy here is the dark matter. Okay, so that's just the really, really in words overview.
One more question: universe is spatially flat now or all time?
If it's spatially flat now, we're going to see in a minute that means all times. Being spatially flat is an unstable point. So if you expand forward a universe that is slightly different from flat, it will become even more different from flat, and we'll see that equation in a second. So the fact that it's flat now means that it was exceptionally flat in the early universe.
And so it means that this flatness is compatible with expansion.
Right. So that's a perfect segue to the actual math, the Friedman-Robinson-Walker metric. So that's just the basic overview. I'm sorry, I'm not an observer, so you guys got me quite a bit on exactly where all this information comes from. But the math, the FRW metric. So what we need to explain is this universal expansion, that V is proportional to some first order constant piece times distance. And so the postulation that comes from that is, let's say that the physical distance to any object is given by some expansion factor that depends on time, plus a coordinate that is independent of time. And then the distance between any two objects is just the distance between their physical coordinates and the velocity, the relative velocity between any two objects, like what we measure. The time derivative only acts on the expansion factor A times the difference in their constant coordinates, which translates, if you factor out another factor of A, to the difference in their physical coordinates, which means HB. So this is the rudimentary thing that this A dot over A, this expansion factor, is what we mean by H. And for distances near us, it's approximately constant. If you look further away, you start seeing the evolution in this parameter. So what does it mean in terms of GR to kind of establish this kind of formalism? It means that our metric is something like this, that the spatial piece of the metric is multiplied by this expansion factor. And then you have to ask, what are the possible things that could go in here? Well, we know it has to be isotropic. We know it has to be uniform. And that's because when we look out at the expansion, we see basically that this Hubble law is the same in all directions. And we look at CMB, we see it's nearly uniform everywhere. We don't like to assume that the universe was just designed to look from uniform from our location, so we're going to extrapolate that it's uniform everywhere, which means this needs to be some kind of constant curvature spatial metric. And the three possibilities that exist is that this could be flat, in which case the spatial part, dl squared here, is just your usual dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. It could have positive curvature, uniform positive curvature, which means it's basically a three-dimensional surface of a sphere. So in two dimensions, we've got something like this.
So in cosmology, you always have three dimensions.
Sorry?
In cosmology, you always have only three dimensions.
Yes. 3 plus 1 dimensions. For Vikings in the class, we're always in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Maybe when Louis takes over, you'll get into higher dimensions. Do you take him into higher dimensions, Louis? 3 plus 1 is fine. So this is in two dimensions. You can see how it would extrapolate out to 3 dimensions. And the point here is that for our flat metric, the curvature, the Ricci scalar on this surface is r equals 0. The Ricci scalar on this surface is r equals 2 over a squared. And then the final one is the negative curvature, which is r minus 2 over a squared. So this piece was that x squared plus y squared plus z squared is constrained to be a squared. This one was x squared plus y squared plus z squared is constrained to be negative a squared. And those are the only three possibilities for uniform curvature spatial components. The three-dimensional analogs of a sphere, a hyperboloid, and the flat space.
What happens to, for example, the flatness condition if you boost? Because it won't be flat on the spatial part in the parameter.
Well, yes it will be, because I mean what we're really measuring here is the Ricci scalar. Okay. So the Ricci scalar is independent of what boosts you do to it.
For an image scale,
I think there's, right? It's plus a squared, but the minus should be on the z or the, because that's impossible.
Yes, yes. You're right. I'm sorry?
The
sitter?
Yeah.
So the sitter is constant negative curvature? Is that right, Lily?
What?
Sorry? And the sitter is constant positive. But the sitter in cosmology means something. When I think of the sitter, is constant H, which is totally compatible with flat. Constant Hubble. So when you say the sitter to me, that's what I know the sitter to mean, is that if H is constant, that's the sitter. And so that's an independent statement of whether it's flat or positive curved or negative curved.
That's because A is exponential, right?
Mm-hmm.
Exponential.
Exactly.
I think if you, the thing is you can define the sitter in many ways, and it's the global. So the original definition of the sitter actually in Norton's paper is not what usually people call the sitter. So the sitter is an hyperbola, and if you just take half of it, you get what you're defining as a flat with constant H.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually was the original definition of the sitter, but nobody people actually use the whole hyperbola, which is then a circle. It's a four-sphere.
Ah.
And then it's no longer.
Thank you. This is something that's always confused me, is what other people mean, what string theorists mean when they say the sitter versus what I know the sitter to be. Okay.
Yeah. But
okay.
It's a choice. You choose globally. Locally, they're the same. But globally, you decide to take half of it, but you decide to take
the whole thing.
You take the whole thing, then you have positive curvature. If you choose half of it, you have
flat, but with constant H.
You have whatever. If you choose a random piece of it, you have whatever it is.
Okay.
So is there a relation between H and R?
Yes. Yes, there is. So the FYW metric in all its glory is ds squared equals minus dt squared plus a squared of t, and then I'm going to normalize by a naught squared, which is the value of A today. Because if I do that, then my spatial metric, all these spatial distances here correspond to distances today. So this is the general FRW metric, and this K parameter just parameterizes those three cases that I said before, that K can be plus 1, 0, or minus 1, depending on if the universe is positively curved, flat, or negatively curved. And in cosmology, the terminology that often goes is this is closed, this is flat, and this is open. And those are the three possibilities for the spatial curvature of the expanding universe. Now, the Ricci scalar, is related to these parameters. And over dot means derivative with respect to proper time here, as measured by somebody who's at rest in the spatial piece, and just moving with the expansion of the universe. So here's the Ricci scalar, and you can see that, yes, it is related to H. It's also related to the second derivative of A, and it's got this piece. And the key here is that if K equals 0, then the only things that are physical are ratios of A over A and A over A. So the normalization doesn't matter. So if k equals 0, I can set a not equal to 1. If k is not 0, then this piece has a physical meaning. And so you have to be careful, and then a naught is not necessarily 1. Okay. So other forms that might make it a little more clear on what the actual geometry is. You can do a variable transformation. And then the actual geometry becomes a little bit more apparent of why this is a sphere for closed, flat for k equals 0, and a hyperboloid. So these are the same metric, it's just a change of variable. But here it's a little clearer that why this is, this corresponds to k equals plus 1, this is k equals 0, and this is k equal minus 1. So these are the three different geometries that you could have on your spheres.
K has dimensions of length.
A has dimensions. If the normalization of A matters, yes, A has dimensions of length. More appropriately, what I usually like to do with this is I'll stick in an A naught squared there. And then it's dimensionless. And K, actually, no, sorry. K does have dimensions of length because this has to have inverse of length. Yeah, so A has dimensions of length because now the normalization of A matters. A has a physical interpretation. A has a value. And it's related to what R naught is today. So if the universe is flat, we can take A to be dimensionless and absorb all the dimensional factors into the spatial piece. If the universe is not flat, then A has dimension. And so this A naught piece is actually important. Okay. Boom, 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 boom. So you plug this metric into the Einstein field equations, and we're going to assume that we've got a perfect fluid on the right-hand side. Perfect fluid. And then the conservation of this perfect fluid in this metric gives us our first cosmological equation. The conservation of this perfect fluid tells us that rho dot plus 3 a dot over a rho plus p equals 0. So this tells us how any form of energy density behaves in an expanding universe. And if you assume an equation of state, so that pressure equals W rho, this implies that rho is always proportional to A to the minus 3, 1 plus W, just from conservation of energy and momentum. Next Einstein equation. G00 equals 8 pi g t00 gives us our first Friedman equation. I dare say this is probably the most important equation in cosmology. Is that h squared equals 8 pi g over 3 rho minus k over a squared. So, if k equals 0, Then we have that h squared equals 8 pi g over 3, the total energy density of the universe, which implies that the total energy of the universe is equal to what's defined to be the critical density, which is defined to be 3h squared over 8 pi g. So when we talk about curvature of the universe, what we're really talking about is what fraction of the critical density is the total energy density in the universe. So it's not really that there are three discrete options here of k plus 1, 0, and minus 1. What this equation is telling us is that if rho is greater than the critical density, then k has to be positive to subtract off the surplus. And if rho is less than the critical density, then k has to be negative to add, to make up the difference. And the difference, the piece that it's making up, is goes over k as a squared. So what this means is that if total energy is greater than rho crit, that means that k has to equal 1. And the difference is given by k over a squared. Rho crit implies that k equals minus 1. So now you see that flat is actually, you know, it's just not one of three possibilities. It's a very finely tuned initial condition of the universe, that the density of the universe is exactly set to the critical density of the universe. It's a very precise relationship between the initial density of the universe and the initial expansion rate of the universe. And so when I was talking about omega, what omega really means is for any species I, omega is the density in I over the critical density. And I was saying that all the fact that those omegas added up to 1 means that we live in a flat universe and rho total is the critical density. Okay, going back to the evolution of, by the way, let me jot down here the other Friedman equation. So the spatial, the time piece of the Einstein field equation gave us this Friedman equation. The second Friedman equation comes from the spatial component, and it relates the acceleration of A to minus 4 pi g over 3 rho plus 3 p. And these two equations are actually redundant with this equation. These two can apply that one.
So where does that one come from? That one comes from
G0i. This comes from actually G-I-I.
Oh, G-I-I.
The spatial component. The trace of the spatial component comes from this, gives you this one. And the time component gives you this one. And then from the Bianchi identities, this one better follow, which it does. So these are the three equations that I probably use the most. But they are, only two of them are independent. You can always derive the other one from two of them.
So what about the other components? Are they just...
Well, the metric is diagonal.
So the metric is...
The metric is diagonal. So the off-diagonal components.
Because we're an isotropic.
We're isotropic and totally uniform, and our metric is nice and simple.
So it's just the Hamiltonian constraint, that's the only thing that... I mean, it's weird because it's. Oh, I guess the GII is.
Yeah, so you have the temporal Einstein and the spatial Einstein.
Sorry, I just.
And then this time. And then together they imply conservation of stress energy. But yeah, that's all we need. So I've had there the evolution. Let me be a little more specific now and say that matter, which had zero pressure for our purposes, when I say matter, I usually mean cold, dark matter, means that rho goes as a to the minus 3. Radiation with pressure equals 1/3 rho means that radiation goes as minus 4. And so if we plot the energy content of the universe as a function of time, or A, depending on which you find more convenient. I'll say A, because then it's nice power laws. Radiation's coming down like this. Matter comes out like this. And if we wanted vacuum, if we want a cosmological constant, that's a constant piece. So radiation, matter, cosmological constant. And this is how the different densities evolve in time. So the universe starts out radiation dominated, had a transition, is now, until recently, matter dominated, and we live about here, more or less. The lambda has just recently taken over. So this is how the different components of the energy density arrive. So we'll talk about, I probably won't talk about too much, about the radiation-dominated era, the matter-dominated era, and then some kind of dark energy-dominated era.
The lambda took over, so the, those supernovas, which...
These supernovas are about a redshift. The redshift of these supernovas are between like 1 and 2.
Okay, and is that in matter or lambda-dominated era?
So the most distant supernova, so lambda domination happened at about a redshift of 1-ish, 1.5. So the fact, what you're seeing from the distant supernova is you're starting to see the turnaround. You're starting to see the effect of that matter was important, now lambda's important. And so you're seeing an evolution in the Hubble expansion rate during the transition from matter domination to lambda domination. And that's how we can measure from the supernova how much lambda there is compared to how much matter.
Because normally if it was in the matter dominated part, we shouldn't see accelerated expansion, right?
If it was in matter domination, you would not see the accelerated expansion. But locally, when you look at the Hubble law nearby, all you ever see is a constant H. When Hubble found his Hubble law, he thought there's a reason why he called it the Hubble constant. Locally, no matter what's happening, H will always look constant. You have to look far enough away to see H evolving. And when you see H evolving, that's when you start seeing, you know, the interplay here of the matter versus the lambda. And in a totally matter-dominated universe, you would see H decelerating. So this happened at about a redshift of 1. This happened at about a redshift of 3,000. Okay. So now I wanted to transition. So that was kind of the first piece. That's my introduction to Friedman, Robertson, Walker. And I was going to try to motivate inflation and why this story is not complete. But first, I wanted to check, because there was a question earlier. The CMB, you guys know where what it actually is, where it came from?
It's the
last scattering surface, right. So just really heuristically, where the CMB comes from is if you plot time here, before about 300,000 years from time zero, the universe was really hot, and you had electrons and protons, and the photons were constantly scattering really, really rapidly between them. When the universe cooled, this formed hydrogen. And all those photons just started freely propagating in the neutral hydrogen. And then later, the universe reionized again. But by that point, the densities were so low that even though it reionized, for the most part, the photons were still just free streaming light through until they reach us today. So what the CMB actually is this snapshot of the last scattering surface from the moment the hydrogen formed.
This reionization part comes from inflation, right? If there's
no
inflation, you don't have it.
No, reionization comes from the fact that we have big, hot, bright things in the universe. If you look at the universe around us, it's all ionized. Reionization, and this is an active area of research, reionization is because of stars and quasars and other hot, bright things that formed in the universe, started emitting all these UV rays, and actually reionized the intergalactic medium.
I mean, right now we do have, as you mentioned earlier, like these gas clouds.
You have some isolated clouds of molecular hydrogen, but overall, the intergalactic medium is ionized.
Okay.
And how exactly that happened, and when exactly this happened, the redshift of this is anywhere often quoted between kind of 10 to 6. The dynamics of when did this happen? How does it happen? Was it mostly quasars? Was it mostly stars? Was it some combination of the two? That's an active area of inquiry that I am by no means an expert on. Now, the motivation for inflation comes more directly from the core observables of the universe. But yeah, so there's my lightning flash introduction to actually what the CMB is. And when we talk about the CMB, we're talking about these photons that have been propagating since the surface of last scattering. Okay, so why do we want inflation? Why is this story not entirely satisfying? One, the universe is really, really homogeneous. Like I mentioned before, the CMB is uniform to within one part in 100,000. This is really, really weird. Because if you look at the expansion rates predicted by this picture of radiation followed by matter followed by lambda, what we see here, sitting up here, we have a light cone coming back. And we see the surface of last scattering in our observable universe. Every point on this surface has its own light cone, which you can extrapolate back to the, what we would say, t equals zero, the Big Bang. And the point here is that on scales larger than 1 degree on the sky, these light cones don't overlap. So every piece of the CMB that's separated by more than 1 degree and the standard picture has never, ever been in causal contact with the rest of the CMB. And this is a little concerning. Now, maybe eventually quantum gravity would tell us that it's perfectly fine that the Big Bang was totally homogeneous down to one part in 100,000, even though it was never in causal contact. But barring that, this is something that kind of cries for explanation. How did the CMB know to be at perfectly the same temperature, even though various points of it were never in causal contact before? So that's one unsatisfying open question. Unsatisfying open question number two is that the universe is flat. And I alluded to this earlier. So the CMB is the major piece of information we know why the universe is flat, like I mentioned up here. And the piece of information that comes, where it actually comes from, is the location of this first peak. This first peak is basically set by the horizon size at recombination, the horizon size on the surface of last scattering. And we think we know the temperature of the CMB. We know kind of the physics that led up to the CMB in this radiation-dominated picture. So we have an idea of what that physical horizon size was at the surface of last scattering. And then we look, and we use that as a standard ruler. So we know this kind of physical horizon size at the surface of last scattering. And that's fixed by just microphysics. And then we propagate that forward in our FRW metric. And if the metric is flat, then the angle, so this is us here, the angle we observe that ruler subtending is just set by normal Euclidean geometry. If the universe is closed, because of that sine squared term in the metric, you end up with a larger angle corresponding to the same distance. And if the universe is open, you end up with a smaller angle. So by measuring the location of this first peak, we get a measurement for the overall geometry of the universe, just from triangles. And that measurement tells us that the CMD is exquisitely flat. It tells us that 1 minus omega total, this sum of all the components in the universe, is minus 1.08 plus 0.071. This is from WMAP7. Very, very, very flat. What's even stranger about this picture, though, is that this is unstable. So if we look back at our Friedman equation that is just poking out from the bottom there, I'll rewrite it here. H squared equals 8 pi g 3 rho minus k over a squared. You can recast this as an equation that says that the absolute value of 1 minus omega total equals 1 over a squared h squared, which is 1 over a dot squared. And so if you take the time derivative of that, the deviation from flatness I'm losing my chalk here. Is proportional to the acceleration of the scale factor. So, remember I said that if the universe contains only matter or radiation, we would expect that A dot, at least until really, 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 really recently, A double dot should be less than zero, which means that this quantity should be greater than zero, and any deviations from flatness should be growing. And you can use that to say, this is the bound today, is that it's flat to within a couple percent. If you extrapolate that back and say, okay, what was it at BVN? If we know it's this close to flat today, at BVN, 3 minutes after the Big Bang, the last time, that's kind of the earliest that we feel really confident that we know what was going on, because we've got good observables from that moment. So the earliest we're really confident we feel pretty good about our understanding is that it should be 1 minus omega today, so this 0.08, times 10 to the minus 14. So if it's really flat today, it was extraordinarily flat in the early universe. And this is a remarkable piece of fine-tuning that we are distinctly uncomfortable with. And then the final current motivation is, this was about why was the CMD homogeneous? Why is the CMD bumpy? I mentioned that we've got this power spectrum in the CMD. There are fluctuations. They're tiny, but they do have fluctuations. If you extrapolate back and say, okay, the microphysics and how the baryon photon plasma is oscillating in its potential wells, and I understand all that. I just need an initial condition to explain this observed spectra. The initial condition looks something like this. A nearly scale invariant initial spectrum of density perturbations across all scales, including scales that were not causally connected at the time of the CMB. So where do you get this? How do you seed these fluctuations that are so small, scale invariant, on all scales, even ones that aren't causally connected? And then for historical purposes, I'll mention the fourth motivation, which was actually the original reason that Alan Guth proposed inflation, but now it's kind of fallen out of favor, is that if you create anything at really, really high temperatures in the early universe, you have a grand unified theory, you create monopoles, you create something big, massive that we don't observe. How do you get rid of them? If you create too much of them, in fact, in the early 80s, when inflation was created, there was these the gut theories of the time had a lot of magnetic monopoles running around. How do you get rid of them? Why don't we observe them? And it was that question that actually led, motivated Alan Guth, who made inflation so popular. He started here and then realized that inflation could also solve this problem, and then later a team of people realized inflation could solve that problem.
I still don't understand the third problem. Me neither. I don't understand the third problem.
The third problem? It's the origin of this initially scale-invariant spectrum of density perturbations that are at the level of one part in 100,000.
Maybe initially, like from the CMB.
So you can write codes, and the code exists, CMB fast, that takes, if you give it initial conditions, it will evolve those conditions forward and model exactly how the primordial plasma oscillates and behaves. And it will give you a curve that looks like this, which is the curve that we measure, provided that you give it at time equals zero an initial perturbation spectrum that looks something like this, that's flat on all scales for the most part.
So, okay, so time equals zero is the Big Bang, and then mm-hmm. that thing is from the CMB.
Yes. So this bumpy thing is the thing we actually observe in the CMB. This piece here is what you need to input into your recombination code at time equals zero to get this out. So these are some initial conditions, some initial fluctuations that are scale invariant on ranging from the largest scales we see in the CMB down to the smallest scales we see in the CMB, just flat line, pretty much the entire way. Minor deviation from scale invariance.
So why is that a problem?
Where did it come from?
Why are the conditions so scale
invariant?
Why are the fluctuations scale invariant?
Exactly. Why are the fluctuations scale invariant, even though there's no causal mechanism that can connect them on bigger scales? This problem, this homogeneity problem, was a question of the magnitude of the perturbations. Why are there not order unity fluctuations all across the CMB sky? This problem is, okay, we've got these really tiny perturbations. Where did they come from and why are they scale invariant? So the reason we like inflation is that it can solve these problems. I lost my voice. So first let me define, what do I mean by inflation? And for right now, all I mean by inflation is a period of accelerated expansion in the early universe. So I'm going to add append here that this picture does not go back all the way to time equals zero. There's another stage here. And in this stage, A double dot is greater than zero. And for right now, that's all I mean when I say inflation. I make no other assumptions for why or how that happened. Why is that useful? one, this so-called horizon problem, which I called over here the homogeneity problem, but it's the fact that horizon, that what we currently see in our observable universe naively has never been in causal contact before. So how is it so uniform? So the co-moving Hubble horizon is 1 over AH. And this just comes from the co-moving horizon is the integral, if you just trace a light ray in our FOW metric. It goes from A equals 0 to some final A, and the integral is dt over A as a function of t. And if you massage that a little bit, you end up that it's a logarithmic integral over this AH. So it's 1 over AH that we call the instantaneous co-moving horizon distance. It's a good handle for things that are separated by less than this distance or on causal contact. Well, during radiation domination, H squared is proportional to 1 over A to the 4th, just from the Hubble law and the fact that density is going as 1 over A to the 4th. Let me skip ahead a little bit. So that means that our horizon distance is going as A, so it's growing during nadir domination. H squared is proportional to 1 over A3, which means AH is going as A to the 1/2. So if we draw a picture here, of distance as a function of time, what is the horizon distance doing? It's growing as A, and then it shifts at nadir domination, it starts growing a little less. So if we look at the size of our universe, say this is the size of our current universe here, it's about 14,000 megaparsecs. Everything, all distances smaller than this are in causal contact. But the key is, this was radiation domination, this is nadir domination. And another way of saying the homogeneity problem is this scale that we see in the CMB was never in causal contact before right now. Unless we add in another piece here. What if, so this is 1 over AH, is this curve. What if 1 over AH shrank and then started to grow? Then it would be possible for the scale that we currently observe as the universe to be in causal contact, fall out of causal contact, and then re-enter. And then we have a mechanism for saying why it's all the same temperature everywhere, because it was initially in causal contact. So how do you do that? If you look at what d by dt is of 1 over AH, you find that it's minus A double dot over A dot squared. So if A dot is A double dot is negative, as it is during radiation domination and matter domination, this is positive, and the thing grows. All we need for the co-moving horizon to shrink like this is a period of accelerated expansion. If the expansion accelerates, then we can make this picture and explain how the universe was once in causal contact, and is now in causal contact again. Schematically, what I like to draw this, even though this is a way of thinking about it, the way I like to think about this is if I append a bit to my picture and I say, this isn't the Big Bang. The Big Bang was down here. And then, nice causal patch that was in a light cone connected to the same point on the Big Bang, inflated to cover what we observe as the last scattering surface. And that's why everything, schematically, this is what inflation is doing. It's saying that I had a piece of the universe that was in causal contact, I inflated it, and then it wasn't in causal contact for a long, long time, now it's coming back into causal contact, but I'm still seeing that same little piece that's all at the same temperature, all at the same properties. Okay, the flatness problem we already saw. That dt of 1 minus omega is minus 2 a double dot over a dot cubed. So what this is saying is, again, if I switch the sign here, now deviations from flatness are going to shrink. Before, my problem was if the universe is decelerating, something starts out slightly curved, it's going to become even more curved. Now inflation can say, no, no, no. The universe could have started with whatever omega you wanted. As long as there's a period of accelerated expansion, you'll get pushed towards flatness. The unwanted relics as long as whatever mechanism in your particle physics creates these relics before inflation, they're going to be totally diluted away by inflation. The volume is growing exponentially, roughly, during inflation. So if you started out with a bunch of monopoles, you're going to end up with less than one monopole per observable universe, or you can easily end up with less than one monopole per observable universe. So you just wipe the board clean of any nasty stuff from the early hot universe that you want to get rid of. And then finally, and this will be the subject of my third and final lecture of this series, is that quantum fluctuations during inflation give you the scale invariant power spectrum. But that's a whole lecture in and of itself.
So why hasn't he got a Nobel Prize?
why hasn't Alan Guth gotten a Nobel Prize? And by the way, it's a little bit of a misnomer. Alan Guth gets most of the lion's share of the credit, but these kind of ideas were floating around. Starobinsky had a hypothesis for that. This Alan Guth really sold it, especially on this side of the Iron Curtain. So he gets the lion's share of the credit for it, but there were precursors that this idea was floating around before Alan Guth. Why doesn't Alan Guth get a Nobel Prize? We don't know. Inflation is not exactly proven in some ways. I mean, it's nice, it solves these problems, but you could have also just postulated that the universe was created this way. You could have just said the Big Bang created a homogeneous, flat universe with the scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations. I don't know what the Big Bang was. I mean, maybe that's just the way the Big Bang is. Maybe that's the only way the Big Bang could have happened. We don't like that. We don't know what the Big Bang is.
It's kind of because it's a scenario and not really a model, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the problem with the
I was going to say, that's the next thing, is that it's a Yes, it's a scenario in search of a model. What triggered this? All I've said so far is we need a period of accelerated expansion. What made the accelerated expansion? How did it end? That's it. The universe started out its life accelerating. Why did it stop? These are all questions that inflation by itself doesn't answer terribly well. Like I said, all I've done here is put in, the universe accelerated. So, and then I'll also mention that the Nobel Prize is distinctly stingy when it comes to theorists. Tends to really, really like observational discoveries, which is why the CMB has gotten two Nobel Prizes, first for its initial discovery and second for the first detection of its black body nature and its fluctuations. But the theorists get no love.
Well, they don't want to make a mistake, I guess.
Yes, inflation could be disproven. And there are other, especially since I'm being recorded, let me say there are alternatives to inflation. I'm not going to talk about them, but there are other ways to solve these problems that do not involve a period of standard inflation.
Okay, so
there are competing theories. No, because we have a lot of freedom in terms of when this happened and what temperature.
That's something I'm wondering. What are the constraints about? Suppose I believe in this kind of inflation. What mm-hmm. are the constraints as to when it happened?
Very, very open. We don't even have an energy scale for when it happened. We don't have an energy scale for inflation. We don't have a reheating temperature for inflation.
But, I mean, there must be a specific, I mean, like, it couldn't have happened, like, for example, after the, after matter, like, since matter domination.
It could not happen after BBN.
Okay.
When BBN happened, 3 minutes, BBN had to happen in a radiation-dominated, well-behaved universe which basically follows the same physics that we know.
Okay, but apart from that, there's no constraints related to
this. There's less hard, fast constraints. We kind of like to have thermal production of dark matter. You know, we've got these dark matter theories, the lightest supersymmetric particle. You'd like that to be produced thermally and then freeze out, which puts inflation has to be end at higher energies than the dark matter mass. So maybe that's pushing you to at least hundreds of GeV. Higher, a number that's often thrown around is 10 to the 15 GeV, because originally it was thought that inflation might be related to gut physics, so 10 to the 15 GeV. But we don't have a rock solid reheating. It's the answer to the question of what temperature did the universe reheat to after inflation.
There is an upper bound from that observation.
From
the non-observation.
Yes, yes. There is an upper bound.
I think it's about
10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 GeV coming from tensors, which I'll get to in the last lecture, that measuring tensors would give us the energy scale of inflation. Measuring the scalar perturbations, which is what we have measured, the one part in 100,000, that does not give cleanly the energy scale of inflation. It's another free parameter there that we'll see. If you measured the gravitational waves from inflation, you would get actually the energy scale of inflation, which is why.
So seeing that we have it measured, we can say that the reheating temperature was less than 10 to the 16 GeV.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that enough to rely on the gut scale?
Is it? Gut scale of inflation is dead with this? But
guess
so the original.
It was always below, like a little bit one below.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that if you have the point is that the gut was giving you monopole, and so the idea is you have to have monopole first, then inflation.
Right.
You have inflation above the gut scale, and you have inflation, then you get monopole. So inflation was always you got to put it below.
You want gut to happen first. Any unwanted relics need to be produced before inflation for inflation to get rid of. Now, I mean, but we don't know how long inflation lasted. We don't know how long, what was there before inflation.
But there's a minimum on how long.
There's a minimum. In fact, if I have time, I was going to quickly calculate that for you. The minimum. The minimum basically comes from this picture.
But there's no maximum.
There's no maximum. Inflation could have lasted a long, 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 long time. Okay, so in the standard picture, how do we realize this? We have now that we want a period of accelerated expansion.
So, sorry.
Go ahead.
Suppose I come back to my original question. Now that we have inflation, we have no upper scale limit on inflation, what does it mean to be a few minutes after the Big Bang?
So inflation...
Because then you could have an arbitrary long inflation, and then you don't know what it is 3 minutes after the Big Bang.
Okay, so maybe... arbitrary. We say inflation happened really, really early. So why do we say that? That inflation was relatively rapid. But I agree with you. We don't know when inflation started. We don't know how long inflation lasted. The easy pat answer to your question is, when I say 3 minutes, I mean 3 minutes since the end of inflation.
Okay.
Because it's when inflation ends that we resume our regularly scheduled Big Bang. You know, we've got this crazy stuff here. Eventually, we've got to get to radiation domination. We get to radiation domination at some temperature, the reheating temperature of the universe. How long did inflation last before that? That's a question I don't have a good answer to.
So if one believes in inflation, the correct way to put it should not be 2 minutes after the Big Bang, but 3 minutes
it's after the end of inflation, possibly, yes. Okay, so the easiest way to realize inflation is with a single scalar field. This is the most boring vanilla form of inflation possible, one scalar field. And if you have a scalar field, the pressure, I'm assuming, this is all probably old news for you. The density is its kinetic term plus its potential term. Its pressure is its kinetic term minus its potential term. Normal classical scalar field. And from, I lost it, from my Friedman equation, which was A double dot over A equals minus 8, 4 pi g over 3 rho minus plus 3 p. We know that to get inflation, we need p over rho to be less than 1/3, minus 1/3. So there's and so what we do to get this is we say the kinetic term is really, really small compared to the potential term, and then we end up with this being approximately minus 1. And voila, we have an accelerated expansion. So we've got a potential dominated, slowly rolling scalar field. So what do I mean by slow roll? This is the, like I said, this is slow roll. Single field inflation. Like I said, the vanilla of inflationary scenarios. The first thing to observe is just from the chain rule, A dot over A equals H squared plus H dot. And we want this to be positive. So we need A double dot to be greater than 0 during inflation. And we want inflation to end. An eternally inflating universe is no good for anyone. So we need A dot to be moving towards 0 during inflation. And those two conditions tell us that we want H dot to be less than zero. So H is decreasing slowly during inflation. But we want H squared to be greater than H dot so that this total thing is positive. So this defines our first slow roll parameter. Condition for inflation, and this really is a rock-solid condition for accelerated expansion. Minus h dot over h squared has to be much, much less than 1. If you plug in to our Friedman equation here, the pressure and the density for a scalar field, you'll find that h dot equals minus 4 pi g phi dot squared. From the Friedman equation, the other one, we have that h squared equals 8 pi g over 3 v, for the most part. We already saw that the potential term has to dominate. So basically, this condition is telling you exactly this, that the kinetic term is much, much smaller than the potential term. The other condition for inflation, or condition for slow roll inflation, is we have the scalar equation, the equation of motion for our inflaton field. This is just the equation of motion in an expanding universe. You've got a Hubble friction term. And we're going to neglect this piece. We're going to say this thing is slowly rolling. So 3h dot is approximately equal to minus v prime. That's our slow roll condition. And that condition is upheld by the second slow roll parameter, which is usually defined lots of different ways. The way I like to define it is just, it's basically just parameterizing the fact that the second derivative piece is much, much smaller than the Hubble friction term. And then you can translate these bounds. Am I missing a page? I'm missing a page. Oh, no. Don't make me do algebra at the board. I'm going to have to do algebra at the board. I know why I'm missing a page. Sorry. Because I went out of order here. Thank you. So you plug in your slow roll solution to your two slow roll parameters, and you end up with some statements about the potential. These are the key statements that we know about the potential, is that we've got this, what's defined as epsilon v, which you can show in the slow roll approximation is about equal to what I call the epsilon h. And it's defined to be 1 over 16 g v prime over v squared. So we know this has to be much, much less than 1. It's a shallow potential. V prime over V, much, much less than 1.
Prime is the time period?
Sorry, it's the derivative with respect to phi.
Oh.
So it's the potential, the derivative with respect to the scale field, the inflaton field. NH, you can show with these, with the Hubble equations, etc., that this is something called NV, eta V, minus epsilon H, so small quantity. And V is 1 over 8 pi G, V double prime over V, much, much less than 1. So these are the two conditions that we have on our inflaton potential. And if these conditions are satisfied, you get slow roll inflation. So these are, now you start model building. Now you start writing down potentials, calculating what epsilon and eta are, And through, and this is what I'll calculate in the last lecture, I mentioned the scale and variant density spectrum. I drew it with a slight tilt for a reason, except I put it backwards. Should be a red tilt. No, that's right, red tilt, this way. The tilt is related to epsilon and eta. So if you want to construct a model of inflation, you have your favorite potential, you calculate epsilon eta, you see if it's compatible with measurements of the density spectrum. And a lot of people wrote a lot of papers playing that game. But the end story, the status, is we don't have a potential. We don't have a good model for the amplitron.
So I understand the potential. It is a function which depends on the amplitron field.
Mm-hmm. It's the potential of the amplitron field. So we've got some field, hopefully.
Phi 4 theory would be phi to the 4.
Exactly. It's some potential for the amplitron field. It satisfies these conditions.
In all of this, you kind of assume that the amplitron field is uniform and not varying.
Yes.
Is that a problem? I mean, is that coming back to your initial problem where you're assuming homogeneous? Or is it like if you have a small patch, that patch, it doesn't matter if it varies because you can just consider a small patch and that patch will expand a little more?
Yes. How do you start inflation? If you start inflation, small patch will inflate, small patch is uniform, everything is uniform. If you can start inflation, can you start inflation? That is the more difficult question. It's an active dispute. If you start with a really, really inhomogeneous inflaton, will a piece of it ever inflate? The slow roll trajectory is an attractor solution. So there's some hope that if you started your scalar field with a big kinetic term, it would quickly go towards the attractor solution of slow roll expansion. So there's that argument, and a lot of the proponents of inflation really like that argument. But this is an attractor solution. It doesn't matter what your initial conditions are. You will find yourself on this trajectory. How that story changes if the universe is incredibly inhomogeneous at the beginning is a little tricky.
So if that's true, then how come we don't find ourselves on inflation after inflation?
Yeah. Inflation ended. Yeah. And inflation ended, the expectation is that the picture that we usually draw, where can I draw a new picture? I need a new picture. Models of inflation. More or less, what you're always looking at is you're looking at some kind of, this is what would be called kind of new inflation. A potential that looks like this. So your scalar field is here. It's slowly rolling. It's slowly rolling. The universe is inflating. It falls down here. It begins to oscillate. And if you oscillate in the bottom of what looks to you like a quadratic potential, you start behaving like matter. And the accelerated expansion ends. Your kinetic term is now comparable to your potential term. And then inflation decays. The inflaton decays. So this is the mechanism of reheating. Somehow the inflaton has to come off its potential and decay. And when it does that, it dumps all of its energy into radiation. And we resume standard Big Bang.
The bottom of the potential should be zero, right? Because you want to be zero at the end of the inflation. Or not.
You
want it to be high, otherwise it won't decay. If it has zero mass, it won't decay into something else. You want to have a big mass.
Well, the mass is the curvature here. Oh, the level.
The level is your cosmo
constant. Exactly. Do we want this to be zero at the end? Well, we're actually kind of looking for a vacuum energy. Now, the scales here, and people have tried. There are papers that try to come up with a unified model that starts with inflation and then ends up with a little bit of relic density that is now the cosmological constant. The scale mismatch here is enormous.
So it's not fine-tuning me, another fine-tuning.
Exactly. It's really difficult to come up with a model that I would love to do it. It feels to me like, yes, this would be something that would be really cool to do, to unify inflation with the current accelerated expansion. But the difference in scales is enormous. And so while there are models that try to do it, they all come out kind of contrived because they are a terrible mismatch of scales.
So I'm still confused. If the potential, the inflation is an entropic solution,
mm-hmm.
and so it doesn't matter what the initial conditions are, you're always going to drift to inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And well, how come after inflation you're not driven to inflation again?
Okay, so the actual phase diagram looks like this.
Start at high energy. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. If you have phi and phi dot, your attractor solutions, your inflation solution is basically here. And you start exactly at high energy. So when we say it's an attractor, what we mean is if we start here, your trajectory quickly goes down to here and then comes in. If you start here, you come up to here. Once you hit down here, you hit the bottom of your well, you begin oscillating, you're dumping energy, you're decaying, you're coupling to matter fields, and you're basically hanging out down here until the inflaton decays away. So that's why inflation doesn't restart. And reheating, of course, is an entirely different and could be easily a lecture in itself on exactly how you reheat the universe after inflation. You hypothesize some kind of coupling between standard model fields and radiation to the inflaton. You decay, you get resonances, you get particle production. This is a rich literature that is not going to fit into 5 minutes.
So do we have other models of inflation without scalar?
Yes. But most of them can be translated into something that looks like a scalar field. You can have models of inflation where, and Louis is much more of an expert on this than I am, where your scalar field is actually a brain modulus, a distance of a brain motion, brain.
Yeah, that's
also scalar.
Yeah.
There's some vector.
There are some vector fields of it. There are some vector models of inflation. They're more complicated.
Never seen fermions.
Never seen fermions. Why don't we have a fermion model of inflation?
Yeah, I think it's.
But yes, there are vector models of inflation. But yeah, usually it's a scalar, and how you interpret that scalar is fundamental or parametrizing something else. From string theory can depend on whether you're working with brain inflation or whether you just think that this is a scalar field that's like a, you know, a normal matter field beyond the standard model.
Is there a signature of this inflation now?
Not really. Like I said, the biggest signature that we could hope for, the signatures, and I'll get more into detail on this in the third lecture. So I mentioned these slow roll parameters are related to the tilt. So we measure the tilt. The tilt tells us that a combination of epsilon and eta is about on the order of 0.04. So there's that, which constrains, you know, these derivatives of the potential. So you've got that. If you were to get tensors, tensors give you a nice, really clean measurement of V during inflation. What the 1 over 100,000, the actual density fluctuations tell you, is basically V over epsilon. So we know what V over epsilon is. V over epsilon has to be, and I'll give you the exact formula in the last lecture. We know what V over epsilon has to be relative to the Planck energy to be consistent with the fluctuations in the CMB. We don't know what V alone is until we get the tensors. We just have an upper limit on it because of the tensor, because we don't have tensors yet.
Could the tensors like rule out inflation?
If you detected it,
I don't know, because you say it gives you clean what V is. So I'm wondering if it could also rule out inflation. I'm just asking.
Inflation is really, really is really, really difficult to rule out. It's one of these models that is incredibly flexible. But let me think. How could, if we measured tensors, yes, there is a measurement. Inflation, and I'll get to this on the last lecture, inflation predicts a very specific relationship between the amount of tensor perturbations and their tilt, the tilt of their spectrum. And that is a hard, fast consistency relation for single field inflation. So if someday if we could measure, and I'll derive the exact relationship in the last lecture, but if someday we could measure not only the amplitude of the tensor perturbations, but their spectral tilt, we could test this.
But it wouldn't rule out double field or triple field.
No, it would not. No. The other thing, what was that? See, I was just thinking that. Can you have blue? I think blue, because the NT is minus epsilon.
You would rule out, GR.
So, yes, if you measure the tensors, even beyond that, if you measure the tensors, the tensor tilt is minus 2 epsilon, if I recall. And epsilon has to be positive. So if you got a blue-tilted gravitational wave spectrum, that would be really, really difficult to explain.
You mean really, really interesting.
Really, really interesting.
what's a smoking gun then for inflation? What would be like? What would you observe this? You would have then there would start having other prizes.
I don't know, a smoking gun. If you could, a couple of things. If from a purely measurement point of view, I would. See, that's what I was about to say. Would really make us happy. It's if we had a nice, compelling particle physics model for what the inflaton is. If you could, give us an inflaton that actually fits into particle physics and has a role to play, that would be fantastic. Once you had a good theoretical motivation for what this potential is, you could start calculating these quantities and testing them compared to the tilt of the spectra, compared to the tilt amplitude of gravitational waves. If that all picture all started to fit, then we would be pretty content. So that, okay, we've got the inflaton. It is the X field. We've seen it in accelerators, or at least seen its decay products in accelerators. We have a comprehensive picture of this entire scenario.
In the vanilla model, that inflaton has to be pretty neutral. Is that a fair remark?
That it can't couple to?
Yeah, it's got to be pretty neutral. Pretty well, not coupling anything, or do you have a different view of that? Not coupling too much, shall we say?
I would say that it's.
It shouldn't be a very odd number.
No, it shouldn't couple. It has to couple a little bit so it decays into standard model particles at the end of inflation. So it has to have some way of communicating to. Otherwise, we just end up with nothing but inflaton in the universe, and that would be bad.
Yeah.
But it can't self-interact very much. Its potential has to be, that comes from the fact that its potential has to be so nearly flat. Its self-interactions are really weak. It's going to be something really, really massive and really, 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 really energetic that doesn't couple very well. It's going to be hard to see directly. But if you had some model extension to the standard model that it fit into nicely, that would make me happy. The other thing in terms of smoking gun and inflation, the ruling out picture, and then I know I'm over time. So another trademark signature of slow roll single field inflation is nearly perfectly Gaussian initial perturbations. And this is why I'm measuring non-Gaussianity in the CMB and non-Gaussianity in large-scale structure is such a hot field right now. Is if you could measure a significant deviation from Gaussianity in these perturbations, you would rule out boring single-field inflation. Okay. Any other questions? So on Thursday, it's a one-hour lecture, and it's going to be mostly kind of on a technical Introduction to Cosmological Perturbation Theory to develop the language that we're going to need to talk about quantum fluctuations during inflation. And then the final lecture will be actually the quantum fluctuations during inflation, where this tilt comes from and how it connects to slow roll.